Well, staying in a medical mode, we have spoken here before about the need to avoid germs. Wash hands while singing a happy birthday twice, for instance, to avoid colds. But we also know germs can be good. You can kill too many, which is why we eat yogurt as a probiotic to replace bacteria killed by an antibiotic. Now, new research says that certain bacteria may not only protect against illness. At least one scientist says we should be mapping our germs, our microbiome, the same way we've mapped our genes, because they are that important. Martin Blaser practices internal medicine at New York University. His research was described in a recent New Yorker article titled "Germs Are Us," the author suggesting that even an increase in childhood asthma, autism, and obesity might have to do with the fact that we have scrubbed so many germs out of our lives. Dr. Blaser joins us now. Welcome.
I'm pleased to be here, Robin.
Let's start at the beginning. What is a microbiome?
The microbiome is all the microbes that live in us, that call us home. We are the home of bacteria and fungi and protozoa and viruses. All of our tenants are the microbiome, and the microbiome also reflects what they are doing to us and with us. 10% of the cells in the human body are human, and 90% are bacterial.
Huh.
So we're 9/10 bacteria, 1/10 human. And if you did a count of all the unique genes in the human body, we have 23,000 human genes, and we have at least 8 million bacterial genes. We're more than 99% genetically bacteria.
Well, what sets you on the path of this thinking that, yes, it makes up a huge percentage of us, but it's much more powerful on our health than we knew?
Well, many people have been interested in the organisms we carry. To doctors, it's called the normal flora. That's what doctors for generations have been taught to call it. And there has been a lot of interest, but we didn't have the tools until recently so that we could study them accurately. And the big tool has been the ability to do DNA sequencing. So now we can say who's there, and by studying their genes, we can ask what are they doing. And that's been really revolutionary. We have such a much better idea of what's going on than we did even 5 years ago.
Well, and you were working with the Helicobacter pylori microbe that lives in the gut. You've been doing this for years. It was thought at one time to cause problems. What tipped you off to the fact that it might have benefits?
Well, I've been working on Helicobacter for more than 25 years, and we were involved in some of the early work showing that having Helicobacter in the stomach increased the risk for ulcers and increased the risk for stomach cancer. And stomach cancer is a very important disease. But we also learned that Helicobacter is disappearing. It was very common early in the 20th century in the United States, and it has been progressively disappearing, and it's disappearing all over the developed world. And as it's disappearing, we can now measure what's the consequence of having it and not having it. And the first things that came out is that it was a good thing that it was disappearing because there was less ulcer disease and less stomach cancer.
Mm-hmm.
But since then, we've found that there's more diseases of the esophagus, like esophageal reflux, or what's called GERD, or reflux, that probably many people you know and many people in the audience have. And there's evidence that Helicobacter is actually protecting the esophagus against reflux. And perhaps one of the reasons that reflux is becoming so common is because Helicobacter is disappearing.
And why is Helicobacter disappearing? Do we know?
Well, we don't know completely, but we know it began about a century ago. It probably has to do with clean water and smaller families and maybe cesarean sections. And now, of course, 70 years of antibiotics.
I want to stay with the cesarean sections because you say that we start building our microbiome the minute we're born, coming through the mother's birth canal and picking up all of her wonderful tribes of germs.
Yeah, so it turns out that mammals have been around for about 150 million years. And the characteristic of mammals is that they give birth to their young live by passage through their mother's vagina. And our ancestors were born that way. And one of the aspects of heredity that the mother gives the newborn baby is her bacteria. And that's been going on, as I said, for 150 million years. And cesarean section has changed that.
Well, but, you know, still, even though you have a cesarean section, you're going to get your bacteria. You're going to get loads of it, pounds of it, as you say.
Yes, but they're not all equal.
Huh.
They're not all the same. And And what we know from studies in people now, that the your initial founding bacteria are different when you have a cesarean section.
Yeah.
And these founding bacteria are very important because they set the stage for development, for metabolic development, for immunologic development, maybe even for cognitive development.
Well, so you started seeing that with the decline of Helicobacter, there was a rise in things like, as you said, GERD. Also, you suspected, you know, asthma?
We suspected asthma because there's a link between GERD and asthma. Some people who have GERD actually develop asthmatic symptoms, and you treat their GERD, their asthma gets better. So we began to look at it, and sure enough, we found also the same kind of inverse association of Helicobacter and childhood onset asthma. That is, people who had Helicobacter were less likely to have asthma than people who didn't. And we showed this in three separate, large, blinded, independent studies. Others have now shown it. There have been studies in mice showing that Helicobacter can protect mice against experimental asthma. As Helicobacter has been declining, childhood onset asthma has been rising.
You mentioned the mice. There was research with mice that showed that the Helicobacter could alter metabolism.
Yes, so the studies on asthma were done by a wonderful group in Switzerland. We didn't do those studies, but we've been beginning to do studies on the effect of antibiotics on the growth and development of baby mice. And we recently just published a paper that showed that mice treated early with very low doses of antibiotics, it changed their development. They developed more fat. It changed their muscle development. It changed their bone development. We saw changes in their liver, and we've now seen immunologic changes as well.
That's Dr. Martin Blaser of New York University. We'll link you to the New Yorker piece on his bacteria work at herenow.org. He wants to map our germs, the human biome. North Carolina State University is studying the chicken microbiome. There's a human microbiome project. In a minute, we'll hear about the American Gut Project. This is big news in the medical world. And by the way, speaking of which, this might be mealtime for you, and we're going to get a little detailed in new thinking about, well, how earwax and human stool might be good for you. Just a warning. But later today, another heads up, back to the Sublime, a new staging of Tennessee Williams' The Glass Menagerie. So that's then, back in a minute on Germs Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science. Find over 200 job openings at mathworks.com.
Welcome back. We're talking about the microscopic life that lives on and in us with Dr. Martin Blaser of New York University. His work in what's called the microbiome, the world of bacteria, was featured in a story by Michael Spector of The New Yorker. In a world full of antibiotics and an obsession with cleanliness, Dr. Blaser wonders what we're losing. And, Doctor, some of the ways we're learning about what bacteria can do have been discovered when people took bacteria and put it in a place where they didn't have it. So there's an example in The New Yorker in which a man had an ear infection. No one could cure it. He stuck his finger in the well ear, the other ear, which wasn't infected, took some wax from that ear, put it in the ear with the chronic infections, and he cured it. Get out of town.
I'm really glad you brought that up because, you know, in our modern life of trying to be ultra super clean, earwax is a bad thing. But, you know, one could argue nature might not have made earwax for such a long time, and it wouldn't be conserved among everybody in the world if it was so bad. And so earwax, it's been known for a long time, has antibacterial properties. And, you know, another thing is that if we look at the skin, it's loaded with bacteria. Everybody's skin is full of bacteria, all different kinds. And by and large, these bacteria are what we might consider good bacteria. They're good for us. They fight bad bacteria. They fight invading bacteria. So when we're washing our hands all the time and we're putting on these alcohol disinfectants all the time, we're mostly getting rid of good bacteria. It's different if somebody has the flu. It's different if they're in a hospital. But day to day, I'm not sure we're doing any good.
Well, and just underscore that. If you have the flu, you don't want to spread those germs. You have to wash your hands all the time. But we're talking
Absolutely.
About these, you know, germs that might be in earwax. It was fascinating to read in the New Yorker story. The doctor who was treating that man with the ear infection, you know, said we tried everything, antibiotics, antifungal drops. And he said it to the reporter as if he were recalling antiquated practices like bloodletting.
Yes. You know, we have become so germophobic, we forget that the world is full of bacteria. We live our lives in a world dominated by bacteria, and generally, most of the time, we live pretty well. So we have to figure out what's the right balance with our bacteria. The idea of killing all of them is a very bad idea because we're going to be killing the good guys.
Well, but transferring earwax is one thing. I'm going to bring up something else, which I just want to flag a warning to our listeners. Some of them are enjoying either breakfast or lunch. But there is the idea of fecal transplants. You know, a healthy stool placed in the intestines of someone who has diarrhea that's been resistant to antibiotic. And what is the thinking there, that it's the bacteria in the stool that will kill whatever's causing the diarrhea?
Well, let me lay this out to you. Ever since antibiotics came on the scene, people have been getting diarrhea after they have antibiotics, during or after. And there's a particularly severe form of this problem due to a bacterium called Clostridium difficile, and many of us call it C. diff for short. And this C. diff diarrhea can be very severe. People can be hospitalized. They can lose their colon. They can lose their life. And sometimes it's extremely difficult to treat. You treat it, and it comes back, and it comes back. It can come back 30 times. And about 20 years ago, one at a time, doctors began to do this fecal transplant where they took fecal specimens from healthy people and put it in these very sick people, and they made them better. And so recently, a group in the Netherlands did a clinical trial where they compared conventional therapy for the C. diff infection with fecal transplant. And in fact, they had to stop the trial in the middle because the results were so much better with the fecal transplant. Now, let me reiterate, these are people who are very, very ill, but they got better with the fecal transplant. And this provides a proof of principle that if we can restore the microbiome using healthy materials, then we can cure illness. Right now, many people are working on trying to understand what's the active ingredient there. What are the active bacteria or the metabolic pathways that are involved? But that was a big breakthrough.
Where do you see this going? I mean, some people are quoted as saying that at some point you might sample the microbiome of every child the first time that child goes to the doctor. What do you see happening?
Well, we are in the early stage of a revolution in both health and in medical care by harnessing the power and the knowledge of the microbiome. There are many different applications. The one that you mentioned, just as people get a blood sample now to test someone's metabolic circumstances, if they got a oral sample or a stool sample, in the future they may have other indices of how people are doing metabolically and immunologically, for example. The microbes in the body really understand human biology, and I'm predicting that some of the next generation of drugs are going to be microbial products, or maybe they will be the whole bacteria, known as probiotics. Not necessarily the probiotics that are on the shelf today in the health food store, but there will be new probiotics that know how to talk to particular T cells and increase the population of some T cells in people who have certain deficiencies, and maybe decrease the population of other T cells in people who have autoimmune diseases, for example.
You're affiliated with something called the American Gut Project. What's that?
Yes, well, that's a wonderful project that Rob Knight and colleagues at the Argonne National Labs, they developed this idea that everyone can learn a little about their microbiome, kind of participatory science, and at a very low price, they will be offered the chance to get DNA sequencing on their microbiome and develop a catalog of what they have. Now, at this point, most of us can't use that information, but by thousands of people sending in specimens, we're going to be able to create a catalog and try to better understand what's the significance of having certain organisms and not having other organisms. So they'll be participating in a big international scientific project, as well as, we hope, helping their own future health.
Dr. Martin Blaser, he practices medicine at New York University, and his research, as we just heard, is into the microbiome, the germs that live upon us. Dr. Blaser, thanks so much.
My pleasure. Thank you, Robin.
Fascinating. And we hope for you, too. Still ahead, the Harvard search through faculty email. Can they do that? They did. The latest news is next, here and now.